Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. The dinner table conversations and monologues by the German Führer that were taken down in shorthand by trusted aide Heinrich Heim, then typed up and turned over to Martin Bormann for safekeeping. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And Ray, I'm going to say a few words before we get started onto the reading, because tonight is May 8, 2014. It is the anniversary date that is important to the study of Hitler and the war years, as you know. So, and I want to say that before I start out with that, that you can, if you've just been listening to this series on Blog Talk Radio, I want you to know that you can find all the episodes of this series by going to www.carolynyeager.net and clicking on Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour under the Radio Archives heading, which is right under my picture. So, because we're on episode 9 now, and so only as we started here, I think, on episode 6, I mean, on Blog Talk. So we had some episodes before that. So this very important day today, May 8th, 1945, Victory in Europe Day, it is the 69th anniversary, so I didn't see any big celebrations going on. Maybe next year there will be on the 70th and certainly on the 75th in 2020. However, Russia is planning their biggest celebration ever tomorrow on May 9th, which is their date that they commemorate this big victory of theirs, and if it's not the biggest one ever, it's the biggest one in a long time. They're going all out, and I've been reading about that. And as some of you might not know, Putin has gotten a bill passed and signed by him just in time for this May 9th celebration, and it's the so-called criminalization of denial of the facts as set out by the Nuremberg Tribunal in 1946-47. Also, for, quote, criticizing the actions of the Soviet Union, unquote, the military during that time and that war. There's no freedom of historical research anymore in Russia, it seems to me, and there had been. There's no freedom of thought and speech about this whole period of history, the period of history that we are dealing with in this program series. And so tomorrow there's going to be this biggest celebration ever staged for the Soviet victory over National Socialist Germany. So I'd like everybody to think about this and also just ask you, Ray, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Are you still feeling positive about Putin?
Yes, and despite that stuff, you know, I think that there are, his hands are tied in an awful lot of ways. And anybody that dares...
You know what? Today he came out, he had a meeting with four leaders in his Eurasian group, and he came out and condemned the Nazi and the rise of the militant nationalism, he called it, militant nationalism in Europe and the rise of Nazism, or the which appearing to be like when Nazism was rising, and really came out strongly against this. He doesn't need to use language like that.
Well, if he wants to keep his position, he does. And, you know, and I disagree with a lot of things he's saying, but I also realize the limitations that he has and the pressure he's under. And, you know, if he disappears, if they replace him with another Russian leader, then that Russian leader might be a guy who is totally dedicated to all that stuff that he's reading off of, Putin is reading off a script right now.
I couldn't disagree more with that. And I don't know why anybody, everything we know about Putin, he's very much in control there, so I don't see how he has to be reading off of a script. But anyway, well, I didn't mean to go into a long discussion about this, and I don't mean to cut you off. We could maybe do a program about this sometime, not on here, though. So I wanted to say that, I'm going to be talking about this on May 12th, somewhat on my Heretics Hour program, somewhat belatedly. And maybe you could come on then for a while, Ray. And but the May 12th is the is one of the anniversary dates, because that was the actual final surrender, because it was the surrender of the Africa Corps, or it's the Battle of Tunisia, or whatever it was called. I have to get updated on that exact terminology, but that was when that took place, not until the 12th of May, and that was the last ones to surrender. So, and I just thought I'd say, too, 15 nations in Western Europe and Eastern Europe commemorate this day as a public holiday. Germany is not among them, thank goodness. But Eastern Germany was until 1990, and so now it's just 14 nations, I guess. And shamefully, Italy is among that number. Mm-hmm. So I want, and so I'm ready to let you start reading. I've got some timeline information, though. I want to ask the listeners if they're hearing any kind of rumbling sound or a staticky sort of like thunder sound coming along with our speech on this program tonight, and if so, if someone would send me an email to carolyn@carolynyeager.net, I've got the email on, and I can, I'd like to know just if you are hearing this or just me. Are you hearing it, Ray?
Absolutely.
You are hearing it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, see, that's not good. That means probably everybody's hearing
it. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking me if I was hearing you loud and clear, and I am. But, no, I don't hear any interference whatsoever.
Okay, all right. Well, I was going to mention, too, I'm taking up a lot of time here, but I was going to mention, too, that I'm using a brand-new mic tonight, the one I was bragging about I was going to be getting, which is a Blue Yeti. It's an absolute beautiful thing. And I was talked to people on Skype with it yesterday. But I didn't hear any of this noise. It wasn't until I got onto Blog Talk Radio that I'm hearing it. And I don't know, you know, there's a lot of things I don't know. So I just want to find out if it's coming across on the recording. So thank you, those who might let me know that. Now, there's on the timeline, we're starting out with the night of 14th and 15th of October. And on the 13th, there was the Germans attempted another drive toward Moscow as the once muddy ground hardens. So, and then on the 14th, the day that we're starting here, the temperatures fell further on the Moscow front and heavy snow followed, which immobilized the German tanks. So, well, they were involved in the drive toward Moscow at this time. And this is so that's the background of what we're talking about. And it's not surprising that now that I've said this here, that Hitler's talking about meteorology and forecasting.
Exactly.
So let's see how that fits in. Pretty interesting. All right, Ray, thanks.
Okay, before I start reading here, I want to say that, you know, the purpose really, I think the primary purpose of Carolyn and I covering this book was to go through it, study it, and offer our thoughts on was this a legitimate, or was it phony, was it not really true, did Hitler really say these things. But I can, you know, I was very impressed with the material that we're going to cover this evening. Because if there's ever any example of Hitler speaking out for what I term the little guy, it comes in the sections that we're going to be covering tonight. And I think you folks will certainly see that. So we'll get underway here with the night of 14th, 15th of October, 1941. And Adolf Hitler says, one can't put any trust in the meteorological forecast. The meteorological services ought to be separated from the army. Lufthansa had a first-class meteorological service. I was terribly sorry when that service was broken up. The present organization is not nearly as good as the old one. Moreover, there are various improvements that could be made to meteorology generally. Weather prediction is not a science that can be learnt mechanically. What we need are men gifted with a sixth sense, who live in nature and with nature, whether or not they know anything about isotherms and isobars. As a rule, obviously, these men are not particularly suited to the wearing of uniforms. One of them will have a humped back, another will be bandy-legged, a third paralytic. Similarly, one doesn't expect them to live like bureaucrats. They won't run the risk of being transported from a region they know to another of which they know nothing as regards climatological conditions, that's to say. They won't be answerable to superiors who necessarily know more about the subject than they do, in virtue of their pips and crowns, and who might be tempted to dictate to them the truths that are vested in a man by virtue of his superior rank. Doubtless, the best thing would be to form a civil organization that would take over the existing installations. This organization would also use the information communicated regularly by telephone and applicable to particular regions which one would owe to these human barometers. It would cost very little. A retired schoolteacher, for example, would be happy to receive 30 marks a month as payment for his trouble. A telephone would be installed in his home, free of charge, and he would be flattered to have people relying on his knowledge. The good fellow would be excused from making written reports, and he would even be authorized to express himself in his own dialect. He might be a man who has never set foot outside his own village, but who understands the flight of midges and swallows, who can read the signs, who feels the wind, to whom the movements of the sky are familiar. Elements are involved in that kind of thing that are imponderable and beyond mathematics. There are bits of knowledge that are developed in the course of an existence intimately associated with the life of nature, which are often passed on from father to son. It's enough to look around one. It's known that in every region there are such beings for whom the weather has no secrets.
Well, you know, let me break in here
and
comment on a couple of things here. You know, this one that he's just saying shows that he has read a lot of philosophy, which he had. In fact, I thought it sounded like he'd been reading Heidegger, but I don't know. But also, when he's talking about people, some of these men he's talking about would know more, but they would not be considered to know more than their superiors, because the superiors have these pips and crowns or whatever.
Sure.
I guess those are spars on your shoulder pads or something. You know, he's talking about the instinct and innate talents.
That's right.
So he certainly is aware of that, and he's not somebody who just is so totally bogged down in authority and hierarchy and says, well, you know, everybody has to, because he's so well known for saying that people have to obey, you know, you have to obey before you can lead, and we need everyone to be obedient and do what they're told to do to make this thing work, and stuff like that. So they make out that he just didn't take into consideration any individuality or individual talents or things, but he certainly did. And when people showed that, he paid attention and was very interested in finding out more about them. And then I think when he said that these people who would be doing this, you know, wouldn't have to follow any kind of rules, and that he said they could even express themselves in their own dialect. I think that's includes quite a bit of irony, because in Germany, well, in so many places, if you don't speak the proper type of German, you know, you were kind of looked down on, because there are a lot of dialects, and some people, you could learn not to speak your dialect, but, you know, you might fall into it sometimes. And he himself was accused of having a dialect. So and he did have somewhat. He had, I guess, a certain speech pattern that was typical of Austrians or maybe Bavarians. But so I just, you know, there's a lot of little things in which he is he is being kind of tongue-in-cheek, or he's being kind of witty, you know. And I'm sure the people there didn't miss that, but some of us reading it might miss it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought I'd bring that out.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. And, you know, the people that he's talking about, which have an innate ability to sense weather patterns and things like this, you know, he mentions don't move them out of that area and let them talk in their own dialect.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion to this little section is there's not much left of it, but it says, where Hitler says, the central office will only have to compare these empirical pieces of information with those provided by the scientific methods and make a synthesis. And very, very valuable right there. He's saying, let the observations of these peasants, if you will, uneducated, whatever, but they know, they sense, they feel nature and the weather, and let their predictions be compared to this so-called scientific, learned method, and see which one of them bears out, and let's see which one will serve us better. In this way, I imagine, we would finally again have an instrument on which one could depend, a meteorological service in which one could have confidence. And that closes that one out, but it was important that you brought that up at the start of the show about the weather and the action on the Eastern Front, and knowing about what weather the military is going to be facing was extremely important.
Yes, it was. It was so important there, particularly there in Russia. And it made all the difference, too. That and something else that's going to come up here,
sure.
I think, that I noticed when I was going through it. So I didn't realize you had so little left to read. I wouldn't have broken in when I did.
I thought
there was more, but I passed by the next lead in here. So now we're going to the 15th, and the 15th, it just says about that in the timeline that the Germans drive on Moscow, so that drive on Moscow was still going on. Mm-hmm. Of course, they never did conquer Moscow. So.
Right.
But this was the time. Yeah. The weather stopped them partly.
Oh, yeah.
I know the weather was just horrible then.
Yes.
And it's only October. And it was an unusual year. They had the gods were not with the Germans when it came to the weather.
Absolutely.
During that time.
Record-breaking cold.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to the 15th of October, 1941, in the evening. Our conquest of power was not made without difficulty. The regime played all its cards, without forgetting a single one, to postpone the fatal event as long as possible. The National Socialist brew was a little strong for delicate stomachs.
Yeah, just to point out that the National Socialist majority, or the Hitler chancellorship, or whatever, was the fatal event that he's speaking
of.
Yes,
good. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Amongst my predecessors, Stresemann was not the worst. But in order to obtain partial gains, he forgot that to reduce a whole people to a state of slavery was to pay somewhat dearly. At the time of the occupation of the Rhineland, a journey to the West was for me a troublesome and complicated matter. I had to avoid the occupied zones. One day, on leaving the Hotel Dresden in Gettysburg, I intended to cross one of these zones. That same morning, an unpleasant presentiment made me abandon the project. 2 days later, I learnt in a letter from Dresden that, contrary to the usual custom, the check at the frontier had been very strict. If I had fallen into their hands on that occasion, the French would not have let me go. They had proofs concerning our activities, and they could have gone on from there to launch a whole machine against me. For the Reich government, it would have been a deliverance. My former opponents would have disguised their joy and shed crocodile tears whilst raising, as a matter of form, a protest that would have been intended to fail.
You know, now he is when he says for the Reich government,
yes,
he's talking about the Weimar regime.
That's exactly right.
And they were considered the Second Reich, huh?
Yes.
Because I found that I had to think about that.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking that the First and Second Reich were before the Weimar, and that the Weimar, I don't know, it's not right, because before that was the monarchy, so but the first one was Bismarck. So, all right, so that. The other thing I think I'll just say now, since I've already started, is that when he's speaking about Stresemann, he was a dominant figure in German politics, and not an enemy, so to speak, pretty much, of the National Socialists. He was head of the German People's Party, which was never a leading party, but he was a leading person because he had an international reputation. He had a cabinet post in most Weimar governments, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize for working out peace. He shared it with this Briand of France. He and Briand worked out some kind of a peace between Germany and France. So, you know, it wasn't a very good peace, but And then I had to look up Gettysburg, that he's when he said he was leaving the Hotel Dresden in Gettysburg. That's in the district of Bonn. So he was in Bonn, and he was wanting to cross over the Rhineland. And, you know, it's pretty interesting that he uses, and I know you like this too, how he follows his presentiments. He gets these feelings. And what if he hadn't followed those feelings so many times? He would have been killed a long time before. And in this case, he thinks he would have been arrested, and he would have been they would have gotten something going on him, you know, and sure. And that would have been the end of the progress that they were making at that time.
Yeah,
go ahead. Yeah,
excuse me, meaning that the French were in cahoots with the Weimar Republic to stall. Absolutely. Any movement that wasn't to their liking. And of course, that's what he's talking about. You know, his own government couldn't be trusted any more than the dang French could be.
Oh, no, they didn't like it. He said they were trying to put off the fateful day when he was going to take power.
And it was to keep the powers that be in power. That's
right.
What it's about.
Right.
Okay. The next sentence here says, even men fairly close to us, meaning those in the party, regarded the Young Plan as a relief for Germany. Now, I'm going to digress here a little bit, Carolyn. This Young Plan of 1929... very much related to the 1924 Dawes Plan. Those were plans offered by the American government to supposedly help Germany in its hour of paying these reparations. Britain and France saw German reparations as a way out of their economic decline after the war. And this Young Plan, what it did was the German payments were pared down and reduced, but stretched out. And then you had these American banks then making large-scale loans, which enabled our former allies to buy American goods on credit. But then the bankers started having second thoughts about those foreign loans. But the main point being here is the American people, to what little knowledge they had of this Dawes Plan and this Young Plan, was... it was presented as a very magnanimous gesture on the behalf of the American government to help Germany get out from under those horrid reparations payments to an extent. They were going to reduce those payments, but they were going to string them out longer, when in reality, as you're going to see here in a little bit, would have just kept the economic strangulation on Germany.
That's
so,
right.
Anyway, I wanted to point that
well,
out.
Well, good. I'm glad you did.
Okay.
Because it follows, it's what follows is relates to that, absolutely.
Yeah, and anyway, he says, I remember having come to Berlin for a meeting. Papen, who was back from Lausanne, was explaining that he had scored a great success in reducing the total of reparations to a sum of 5,800 million marks. I commented that if we succeeded in getting together such a sum, we ought to devote it to German rearmament. After the seizure of power, I immediately had all payments suspended, which we could already have done as far back as 1925. In 1933, the Reich...
Yeah, well, so then, you know, this you already explained these payments, I guess, and that this was O&D. Okay, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that, of course, the American bankers were making... profits hand over fist by loaning this to Germany and keeping it eternally in debt, which is that's what this Federal Reserve System and American banking and all is all about. So,
well, right, and you know, Hitler had a much better idea,
mm-hmm.
and he was the only one that was bold enough to have ideas like this. And as we're going to see now, you know, he did something very different.
Absolutely. In 1933, the Reich had 83 million marks worth of foreign currency. The day after the seizure of power, I was called upon to deliver immediately 64 million. I pleaded that I knew nothing about the whole business, and I asked time to reflect. In the course of inquiring when this demand had been formulated, I was told 3 months ago. I decided that if people had been able to wait 3 months, they could easily wait another two. My advisors displayed a childish fear that this would cost us our reputation as good payers. my view was that German prestige would not be enhanced by our paying under this threat of blackmail, but much more by our ceasing to pay. The inflation could have been overcome. The decisive thing was our home war debt. In other words, the yearly payment of 10,000 millions in interest on a debt of 166,000 millions. By way of comparison, I remember that before the war, the total cost of imports paid for by the German people was 5,000 million. To pay the interest, the people was compelled to walk the plank with paper money, hence the depreciation of the currency. The just thing would have been, firstly, to suspend the payment of interest on the debt, and secondly, to put a very heavy tax on the scandalous war profits. I'd have forced the war profiteers to buy, with good clinking coin of the realm, various securities, which I would have frozen for a period of 20, 30, or 40 years. Weren't there dividends of 200% and 300% the reason why our war debt had reached such a level?
Yeah, see, now that's really not, you know, I mean, he doesn't say it, but he's talking about Jewish usury there.
Exactly.
You know, and explaining how it works and why nobody should go along with it.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
And he says, inflation is not caused by increasing the fiduciary circulation. It begins on the day when the purchaser is obliged to pay for the same goods a higher sum than that asked on the day before. At that point, one must intervene. Even to shock, I had to begin by explaining this elementary truth, that the essential cause of the stability of our currency was to be sought for in our concentration camps. The currency remains stable when the speculators are put under the lock and key. I also had to make shocked understand that excess profits must be removed from economic circulation. I do not entertain the illusion that I can pay for everything out of my available funds. Simply, I've read a lot and I've known how to profit by the experience of events in the past. Frederick the Great already had gradually withdrawn his devalued thalers from circulation and had thus reestablished the value of his currency. All these things are simple and natural. The only thing is, one mustn't let the Jew stick his nose in. The basis of Jewish commercial policy is to make matters incomprehensible for a normal brain. Boy, how pertinent that is.
Mm-hmm.
People go into ecstasies of confidence before the science of the great economists. Anyone who doesn't understand is taxed with ignorance. At bottom, the only object of all these notions is to throw everything into confusion. The very simple ideas that happen to be mine have nowadays penetrated into the flesh and blood of millions. Only the professors don't understand that the value of money depends on the goods behind that money. One day I received some workers in the Great Hall at Obersalzberg to give them an informal lecture on money. The good chaps understood me very well and rewarded me with a storm of applause. To give people money is solely a problem of making paper. The whole question is to know whether the workers are producing goods to match the paper that's made. If work does not increase so that production remains the same level, the extra money they get won't enable them to buy more things than they bought before with less money. Obviously, that theory couldn't have provided the material for a learned dissertation. For a distinguished economist, the thing is, no matter what you're talking about, to pour out ideas in complicated meanderings and to use sibylline incomprehensibility. Boy, that's a wonderful set right there about economics and how the average Joe, even more so today, is in the clutches of that money power, resigning everyone to eternal debt slavery.
You know, I remember when I discovered that money was simple.
Sure.
And that this whole idea that economics was and understanding banking and things like that was too difficult. You know,
sure.
It took a genius, and these mm-hmm. economists had to be the brightest people, naturally all the Jews, uh-huh. To be able to do it. And that's what they make people think. And it's just not true. And I love this paragraph where Hitler says he had some workers at his house, and he gave him a lecture on money, and he said, these guys understood me very well. They didn't have any trouble.
Sure.
That's just so good, you know. It's so true.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I read that section right there, Carolina, it took me back to 1964, and I was taking a college class on economics at that time, and Vietnam was really heating up, and our economics professor told us that, you know, he'd been very closely following this thing going on in Vietnam and how we were kind of starting to take a licking over there. And he said he wrote a letter to the United States government, particularly the State Department, that as an economist, he said the way to bring these people to their knees over there in North Vietnam is to flood their country with counterfeit currency. He said, and when these B-52s fly over to drop all these tons of bomb, have them drop bales of counterfeit North Vietnamese currency. And he said, when that stuff hits down there and these people run and get it and start taking it to spin and everything, the whole economy of North Vietnam is going to collapse, which was, to me, that was simply brilliant. And he said he received a letter back from the State Department saying, oh, no, we couldn't do that. No, we will not engage in such as that. Well, naturally they wouldn't, because that's the damn game they play. But
yeah.
I thought of that very thing when I read this simple approach to money and debt.
Yeah, and he says the easy way to give people more money is to make more money.
There you go.
You know, okay, paper money, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But that's then there's some things that have to go right, you know, you have to do right behind that. You can't just keep printing paper money. But still, that's what puts more money in circulation.
Sure, sure. And he even took a swipe at paper money.
Oh, yeah.
When he talked about jingling coin of the realm, let's use that to pay the debt.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that puts the big boys ill at ease.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the 17th of October. Midday, and I've got a couple more timeline things. On the 16th, there was the Soviet Union, remember that, government begins to move eastward to Samara, a city on the Volga, but Joseph Stalin remains in Moscow. They were still retreating then, mm-hmm. pretty much, and the citizens of Moscow frantically build tank traps and other fortifications for the coming siege. On the 17th, something interesting here, the destroyer USS Kearney is torpedoed and damaged by a German U-boat, U-568, near Iceland, killing 11 sailors, American sailors, and these are the first American military casualties of the war. Well, again, it's October, but there they are over there by Iceland sticking their nose in things where they don't belong, because it was a destroyer, you know, it wasn't a freighter or anything. So that's what was taking place then.
Well, and the thing about that, Carolyn, of course, was that FDR covertly gave assignment to our military, any chance they could get to fire on German submarines, which surfaced, at that time they had to surface to refresh their air, things like this. And you know, it's October 1941. It's not December when the Japanese attack
got
us into that war. And
mm-hmm.
He told those guys, any chance you get, fire on Germans. Well, that the Kearney got hit by a submarine, which had been fired upon by the Kearney. And it was a defensive move. And, of course, nobody ever knows this. It was just a member of the Wolf Pack.
Wikipedia doesn't include that part.
Mm-hmm. No, because this was strictly a defensive move, because Hitler had stressed to his naval people in particular be careful what you do here, because we don't want to incur, we don't want to give the Americans any reason.
That's right.
To knock the hell out of us. But
or to enter the war.
Yeah, that's right. And these fellows on board that submarine, the Kearney was trying to, like, it was fired upon, they dropped depth charges, whatever. But that submarine decided, hey, it's either us or them. They're trying to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
So they took defensive measures. And, of course, that's presented to the American public as a dastardly attack upon an American destroyer by a German submarine.
Right.
So, anyway, 17th of October, 1941, midday. With the fall of Odessa, the war will be practically over for Romania. All that's left for the Romanians to do is to consolidate their position.
Okay, and I've got a little thing here. I guess I'll read it real quick.
Okay,
The siege of Odessa was part of the Eastern Front area of operations in 1941, primarily conducted by Romanian forces and elements of the German Army's 11th Army. Due to the heavy resistance of the 9th Independent Army, which was Soviet, their initial heavy resistance, and the rapidly formed separate coastal army, which was also Soviet, which was formed from the coastal group of the 9th Army and the Black Sea Fleet forces in Odessa, it took the Romanian army 73 days of siege and 4 attempts to take the city, during which they suffered 93,000 casualties, while the Red Army suffered around 41,000 casualties. However, others claim or suggest that the Red Army suffered 60,000 casualties. Anyway, this siege finally ended on October 16th, which is the day before we're reading here. So he's talking about the fall of Odessa, which just took place.
Sure.
Okay.
In the face of Antonescu's success, the opposition will collapse. Peoples always give themselves to victorious commanders. Reactionaries are like hollow nuts. They take a whisper uttered by one booby and transmit it to the other boobies. They make a real rumor, and they end by persuading themselves that here is the true thundering voice of the people. In actual fact, what they hear is only the amplified echo of their own feeble voices. That's how, in some quarters, the people is credited with feelings that are utterly foreign to it. Antonescu has the merit of having intervened in favor of Codronu. Now, I'll stop right there for a second. This, I think his name was Corneliu Codronu, but he was as patriotic a Romanian as ever. He was a dedicated National Socialist,
mm-hmm.
You know, and he had a big following. And, you know, the guy looked like Tyrone Power.
I know, he's handsome.
He was a very, very handsome fella. And the more I read about him, the more I felt in sympathy with him. And it's a shame that, you know, his efforts were not rewarded. Apart from the Duce, amongst our allies, Antonescu is the man who makes the strongest impression. He's a man on a big scale who never lets anything throw him out of his stride, and he's incorruptible. What's more, a man such as Romania has never had before. I may say that there was nothing in Romania, including the officers, that couldn't be bought. I'm not even alluding to the venality of the women, who are always ready to prostitute themselves to gain promotion for a husband or a father. It's true that the pay of all these servants of the state was ridiculously stingy. Antonescu now has the job of building up his state by basing it on agriculture. For industry, he'd need abilities that his peasant class, which is sober and honest, does not possess. On the other hand, a usable administration can be recruited amongst this class, but it must be small and it must be adequately paid. Whoever in Romania continues to abandon himself to corruption will have to be shot. There must be no shrinking from the death penalty when it's a question of strangling an epidemic. The present type of official, when faced with such a threat, will prefer to give up his post, which can then be offered to somebody respectable. It goes without saying that the officers must be paid so that they will no longer be obliged to find subsidiary occupations in order to keep alive. To bring decency into civil life, the first condition is to have an integral state, an incorruptible army. police and administration reduced to a minimum. But the first thing above all is to get rid of the Jew. Without that, it will be useless to clean the Augean stables. If Antonescu sets about the job in this manner, he'll be the head of a thriving country, inwardly healthy and strong. For this purpose, he has a good peasantry. Hungary has nothing like it, and natural riches. Moreover, Romania is a country with a thinly scattered population.
Oh, that's very interesting.
It is.
Uh-huh.
Quite an observation.
Yeah, and see, he has nothing against the peasants. He
that's
says
right.
these are good peasants here, and Romania is going to have an agricultural country because that's what it has, that's what its wealth is.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense, and
it suits
he's very supportive.
Yeah. Hmm? Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, moving on to 17th of October in the evening. In comparison with the...
Well, we've got special guests.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we do. Special guests. Reich Minister Dr. Tote and Gauleiter Sokel.
Okay, and Dr. Tote was the head of the Tote organization, that huge organization that did all the building in the Reich, and then when the war came, did all that infrastructure building and roads and bridges, everything that needed to be done. He was a genius, and unfortunately, he died, like maybe it was in 1942. He died in a plane crash, but at this point he was still around.
Okay.
So.
In comparison with the beauties accumulated in central Germany, the new territories in the east seem to us like a desert. Flanders, too, is only a plain, but of what beauty? This Russian desert, we shall populate it. The immense spaces of the Eastern Front will have been the field of the greatest battles in history. We'll give this country a past. We'll take away its character of an Asiatic steppe. We'll Europeanize it. With this object, we have undertaken the construction of roads that will lead to the southernmost point of the Crimea and the Caucasus. These roads will be studded along their whole length with German towns, and around these towns, our colonists will settle. As for the 2 or 3 million men whom we need to accomplish this task, we'll find them quicker than we think. They'll come from Germany, Scandinavia, the Western countries, and America. I shall no longer be here to see all of that, but in 20 years, the Ukraine will already be a home for 20 million inhabitants beside the natives. In 300 years, the country will be one of the loveliest gardens in the world. As for the natives, we'll have to screen them carefully. The Jew, that destroyer, we shall drive out. As far as the population is concerned, I get a better impression in White Russia than in the Ukraine. We shan't settle in the Russian...
So White Russia was sort of like what we call Belarus.
Yes.
Which means White Russia.
Right. And he was more impressed with them than...
Yeah, with Ukrainians.
Than Ukrainians, sure.
Yeah.
We shan't settle in the Russian towns, and we'll let them fall to pieces without intervening. And above all, no remorse on this subject. We're not going to play at children's nurses. We're absolutely without obligations, as far as these people are concerned, to struggle against the hovels, chase away the fleas, provide German teachers, bring out newspapers. Very little of that for us. We'll confine ourselves, perhaps, to setting up a radio transmitter under our control. For the rest, let them know just enough to understand our highway signs so that they won't get themselves run over by our vehicles. For them, the word liberty means the right to wash on feast days. If we arrive bringing soap, we'll obtain no sympathy. These are views that will have to be completely readjusted. There's only one duty, to Germanize this country by the immigration of Germans, and to look upon the natives as redskins. If these people had defeated us, heaven have mercy. But we don't hate them. That sentiment is unknown to us. We are guided only by reason. They, on the other hand, have an inferiority complex. They have a real hatred towards a conqueror whose crushing superiority they can feel. The intelligentsia, we have too many of them at home. All those who have the feeling for Europe can join in our work.
Well, now, you know, he's talking about the Ukrainians, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what I think, but, too, and he doesn't have a high opinion of Ukrainians in general. Mm-hmm. They were in a pretty primitive state, mm-hmm. It's true. I'm sure they've improved since then, but he's saying that we're not going to try to bring them up to a higher level. We're just going to leave them the way they are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
In this business, I shall go straight ahead, cold-bloodedly. What they may think about me at this juncture is to me a matter of complete indifference. I don't see why a German who eats a piece of bread should torment himself with the idea that the soil that produces this bread has been won by the sword. When we eat wheat from Canada, we don't think about the despoiled Indians. The precept that it's men's duty to love one another is theory, and the Christians are the last to practice it. A Negro baby who has the misfortune to die before a missionary gets his clutches on him goes to hell. If that were true, one might well lament that sorrowful destiny, to have lived only 3 years and to burn for all eternity with Lucifer.
See, he doesn't believe that. He's saying that the Christians believe that, and they don't have any problem believing that this child will, if it dies before it gets saved or whatever, is going to go to hell, even though he's only lived 3 years. Now he gets to have eternity with Lucifer. I mean, really, it's quite a picture. He's standing there, just kind of an insanity.
Well, yeah, and what he's doing there, to me, is using reason and logic to counter emotionalism and
well, it's not only emotionalism, it's just, you know,
faith or, you know,
hypocrisy.
Yeah, well,
in a sense.
Exactly. For Ley, L-E-Y, it will be the job of his life to drag that country out of its lethargy. Fields, gardens, orchards. Let it be a country where the work is hard, but the joy pays for the trouble. We're giving the German people what it needed to assert. We've given the German people what it needed to assert its position in the world. I'm glad that this call to the East has taken our attention off the Mediterranean. The South, for us, is the Crimea. To go further would be nonsense. Let us stay Nordic. In any case, in our country, the sunny season sometimes goes on until November. In Berlin, February brings the first promises of spring. On the Rhine, everything flowers in March. In the Ukraine, more than anywhere else, it would be a mistake to install flour mills that would drain off the wheat from immense territories over a radius of over 400 kilometers, for example. We should rather build windmills all over the place to supply regional needs and export only the wheat demanded by the large centers. How I regret not being 10 years younger. Tot, you will have to extend your program. As for the necessary labor, you shall have it. Let's finish the road network and the rail network. We shall have to settle down to the task of rebuilding the Russian track to restore it to the normal gauge. There's only one road that, throughout all these last months of campaigning, was of any use to the armies on the Central Front, and for that I'll set up a monument to Stalin. Apart from that, he preferred to manufacture chains of mud rather than to build roads. What a task awaits us. We have 100 years of joyful satisfaction before us.
He loves these kind of challenges.
Yes.
He just would love to have been able to do what he wanted to do. In the East there.
And most people probably know on that sentence here saying about settle down to the task of rebuilding the Russian track to restore it to the normal gauge. You know, that
the railroad track.
Yeah, that's, you know, how wide apart it is. And Russia chose a wider gauge and so the track was useless to locomotives and things like this of anywhere else.
Right, and that's why when those trains were carrying those Jews to the east, they had to stop. They had a place to stop there at the end of at the eastern part of Poland when they came to the end of their regular gauge railroad tracks, and they had to shift these people over to other trains of that fit the Russian tracks, and that's what was going on there in that stop at the places like Treblinka and Belzec and so on. But anyway, I was thinking this time that maybe these people did say some things, like they're the guest of honor, like Dr. Tote here and Dr. Sauckel, but maybe the Heim, the note taker, was under the impression that he should only take down the words of Hitler, and so didn't copy any of those, because I know later on there are some comments from the guests, you know, and there was a question from someone in an earlier one that we read, but it was Hitler's friend. But, you know, I just wonder why there's not none of that's in here, although maybe they mostly just kind of agreed with him and so on, didn't say anything very important.
Well, true, and as we both know, Bormann was editing this, so to speak, and maybe he thought some comment might be superfluous and just...
Well, we don't even know how much he edited it. You know, everybody wants to say, oh, he was editing it. This Heim typed up his... Well, supposedly he looked it over to see that it was okay, but maybe he didn't make so many suggestions or anything. I think we don't know. But he was putting it away in his safe to keep it for safekeeping. That's where he was keeping them all, in his big safe. Now we are kind of we've got 5 minutes left, and we've got kind of a long one here.
Yeah, it's about a page and a half.
Yeah, but why don't you just start reading it? You might even be able to read it in.
In
5 minutes.
It's the night of the 17th, 18th of October, 1941. Hitler says, "I never close an eye during the night of the 9th and 10th of May, 1940, or that of the 21st to 22nd of June, 1941." In May of 1940, it was especially worry about the weather that kept me awake. I was filled with rage when the dawn broke, and I realized that it was 15 minutes earlier than I had been told. And yet I knew that it had to be like that. At 7 o'clock came the news. Ibn Emael has been silenced. Next, we hold one of the bridges over the Meuse. With a fellow like Witzig, we'd have been able to take the bridges of Maastricht before they were blown up. But what difference did it make whether they were blown up as soon as we held the very high bridge commanding Liege, 60 meters above the river level? If that had been blown, our engineers would have found time to put it back into shape. It was wonderful how everything went off as arranged. When the news came that the enemy was advancing along the whole front, I could have wept for joy. They'd fallen into the trap. It had been a clever piece of work to attack Liege. We had to make them believe we were remaining faithful to the old Schlieffen plan. I had my fears concerning the advance of von Klug's army, but everything was well prepared. 2 days after our arrival at Abbeville, we could already start our offensive to the south. If I had disposed then of as many motorized troops as I have now, we'd have finished the campaign in a fortnight. How exciting it will be later to go over those operations once more. Several times during the night, I went to the operations room to pore over those relief maps. What a lovely place Felsenest was. The birds in the morning, the view over the road by which the columns were going up the line. Over our head, the squadrons of aircraft. There, I knew what I was doing. In the air attack on Paris, we confined ourselves to the airfields to spare a city with a glorious past. It's a fact that from a global point of view, the French are behaving very badly, but all the same, they're closely related to us, and it would have hurt me to be obliged to attack a city like Lyon with its cathedral. On the 22nd of June, a door opened before us, and we didn't know what was behind it. We could look out for gas warfare, bacteriological warfare. The heavy uncertainty took me by the throat. Here, we were faced by beings who are complete strangers to us. Everything that resembles civilization, the Bolsheviks have suppressed it. And I have no feelings about the idea of wiping out Kiev, Moscow, or St. Petersburg. What our troops are doing is positively unimaginable. Not knowing the great news, how will our soldiers, who are at present on the way home, feel when they are once more on German soil? In comparison with Russia, even Poland looked like a civilized country. If time were to blot out our soldiers' deeds, the monuments I shall have set up in Berlin will continue to proclaim their glory 1,000 years from today. The Arc de Triomphe, the pantheon of the army, the pantheon of the German people. And that concludes that.
That was just a wonderful passage. And we don't have time to speak about it, so we'll have to say good night. Good night, Ray. Good night, listeners.
Thank you, and I appreciate you folks tuning in. Good night.